compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right. Taco Tuesday. That's right. That's where that sound effect comes in. I wanted, but first of all, welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. My number is 888-914-9149. And I wanted to just get a little follow-on to Cecilia, whom I spoke to before the break. And if you were listening, you heard her talking about the situation where if she gets married, she had an invalid first marriage. But if she gets married again, she had some questions with regard to if, you know, she has fibroids in her uterus. And so there's a question about whether or not that would be permissible for her to conceive a child, knowing that she might have these problems. So what I wanted to do is to recommend an organization in the Diocese of Austin. It's the John Paul II Life Center. And this place is really good. I know a number of the people who work there, and I've had an opportunity to really get to know a lot of the work that they do. And what they do is they help women who are having fertility issues. And that would be a place that you could go to get medical information. You would be in a position to talk to people who not only have the medicine down, but they are also very familiar with the church's moral teaching, and they use NAPRO technology. They can give you suggestions on how to overcome some of these issues. So that would be my advice. So the John Paul II Life Center in Austin. Get in touch with them and tell them Patrick Madrid sent you. Now, their website is JPII, so the Latin numeral for two, JPIILifeCenter.org. JPIILifeCenter.org. And they can help you. And I hope that you, Cecilia, will have a chance to get in touch with them. I think they'll be of great value to you. 888-914-9149. Now let's go to Vian, listening in San Diego. Good morning, Vian.
Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. I've been struggling with something that has been difficult for me and my fiance. We've been engaged for 6 months, but this is something a little more recent, like regarding the vaccine. And I expressed to him how, you know, I'd like to just, I don't feel comfortable as of now. It's not like I'm never going to take it, but he's really trying to make me feel better about it, and he's taken it already. And
to take what?
Both the vaccine.
Oh, for, I see.
The COVID vaccine. Mm-hmm. And I recently got COVID, and I recovered, thankfully, and it was just more of a push for me to feel better about getting it. And he's not being forceful, really. It's just him trying to explain how it's, you know, it's been recognized by the church that it's fine, you know, and we're both practicing Catholics, and he just, it's really tough for both of us because we're not on the same page about it, and he's worried about our future when we get married and when we have other decisions to make that will require us to do things, or, you know, getting advice from the doctor. And I'm just kind of like not sure how to approach this, and it's almost like if this isn't going to, if we're not able to get through this, like it's going to be hard for us to stay together, unfortunately, because we both have older parents that are, you know, they're just, they've gotten the vaccines, but we just want to be careful around them. And it's been a struggle for me to be okay with getting it, and I don't want this to be something that will just, you know, not keep us together. It's just so sad to think about that.
I can imagine. Well, you love each other and you're planning to get married and you have your whole life ahead of you, so I could understand why this would be really distressing for you, Vian. I think you identified the issue here very well, and that is that if you're not able to reach a consensus between the two of you on something like this, what other things might you not be able to share in common in marriage? Now, this is in the times we're living in right now, this vaccine has become a real dividing line between people, between fellow Catholics, between fellow citizens. And there in the very strong feelings on both sides of this issue. And what I find distressing is how it's come to the point where whichever side you're on, and I'm not speaking about you personally, but just the you rhetorically, whichever side of the vaccine question you're on, you tend to see the other person as evil or as malicious. And that would go in both directions. So the people who do not want to get vaccinated, they see a kind of evil and maliciousness on the part of people who are harping on getting vaccinated. And it goes in the other direction too, where the people who are vaccinated, they think these people are stupid or they're just wicked or what's wrong with them? Why won't they get vaccinated? So it's bewildering to me to see how it has become such a divisive issue with so much antagonism that's riding on this on both sides. And because of the nature of this thing, I think it's a much more of a red flag than it might have been, say, 5 years ago or even 2 years ago if you just had a difference of opinion about vaccines. And if it were, well, when we have children, are we going to get them vaccinated? And let's say the two of you couldn't quite agree on that. That would still be a red flag because it's an important issue. But I think it has grown to such proportions now, given what we're going through with this insane vaccine division that we have between us, that I think you're right and wise to really stop and think carefully about this. If your fiancé is implacable and unwilling to see that maybe you, for whatever your reasons are, that you're not going to get vaccinated, if for him that's an intolerable situation and he just won't accept that, then it seems to me that that would be a really big sign not to go forward, as painful as that may be. Now, if it turns out that either you are more malleable and more willing to concede, or he is more willing to concede, then I would think you've got something to work with there. But if you're immovable and he's immovable, I don't know what to recommend in terms of this relationship. And I don't know anything else about it, just what you've told me. But all other things being equal, I would say this is a pretty big red flag, you know?
Yeah. He's been able to, I've always told him about like spiritual direction, and he didn't initially have a spiritual director. And he met with him just yesterday and was feeling more at peace with it because he was getting just the support and trying to like the spiritual director was just saying the same thing, like how you guys need to be on the same page about things because there's mm-hmm. going to be so many things down the line, and I understand that. And in marriage it's a daily sacrifice, and I just, it's a lot to process. And just looking back at all of the beautiful things that we've been able to do together with our faith and growing in that, it's just so hard to imagine that that'll mm-hmm. just all go away.
I know.
Because of this.
I know. If you were my daughter, Vian, the advice I would give you would be to sit down with him and say, I love you. You know I want to be married to you, but this is something that's creating a rift already. And if I need to know, is this something that will be a permanent rift if I decide not to get a vaccination? I mean, can you live with that? And can you live with me normally with that? And give him the opportunity to say yes or no. And if he says no, I can't live with that, then my advice to my daughter would be, then just call it off. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you were to call it off and just say, well, then I can't live that way, and we're just going to have to end things right now, he may come to his senses and say, you know what, I've thought about it, and yes, I can live with that. And I don't prefer it, but I'm willing to do this because I love you. And who knows, maybe in due time you'll change your mind or he'll change his mind. Those things do happen. But one way to get his attention, if he says to you that this is a deal breaker, then I would call it off. And then see how much he really loves you and how committed to you he really is. Or is he more committed to the vaccine than he is to you? That would tell you a lot, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Far better that you get your heart broken now and you have to go through the difficulty of this situation now than if you get married and you have to do it a year into your marriage or 5 years or 10 years into your marriage. It's better to do it before you get married if you have to do it at all.
Yeah, that's what my sister told me too.
Mm-hmm. If he really loves you and he's willing to sacrifice anything for you, then that will come out in the wash in this situation. And you will also find, if that's not the case, that you don't come first. In which case, why would you want to marry him?
Right.
You know, every husband should be willing to sacrifice his life for his wife. And anyway, I feel like I'm repeating myself and I don't want to subject you to that, but do you see the point I'm making?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, you're strong. I will indeed pray for the two of you, that there will be a very happy outcome here if it's God's will. Ask God to show you the right thing to do and ask God to give you the graces necessary to do the right thing. Ask him for the virtue of prudence to know what is the right thing to do in this situation right here. I've given you some suggestions, but ask God and he'll show you.
Okay. I will. Thank you.
You are welcome. And I'm really glad that you called me today. I know this is a painful topic, but I hope it's helpful to you to talk it out a little bit more. Thank you, Vian. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
All right, we are back. By the way, that little book I was talking about a while ago on the program, it's called My Daily Bread. Many of you are familiar with it. Maybe you've even had it around for a long time. I have, from the time I was a kid. The author's name is Father Anthony Paone, P-A-O-N-E-S-J. And I really like this book. It's published by the Confraternity of the Precious Blood, and it's really got a lot of great benefits to it in terms of like a daily reader. You just read a little bit at a time. It's got brief kind of meditations on things going on in your life. I have found it very helpful for me personally, and I was surprised and happy to see it's $5. You know, when you buy it online, I think Tan Books has got it on sale right now, so it's really a good deal. But wherever you get it, if you're looking for something in your life that will give you some structure on how to try to live a good life as a follower of Jesus and make sense out of stuff that's going on in the world, this has helped me an awful lot, so I recommend it to you in the same way. Again, it's called My Daily Bread by Father Anthony Paone. Let's go back to the phones now. Let's start off with, it looks like we have maybe a glitch with some of the phone lines. So we're going to have to work that glitch out and let me know when that's ready to go, Cyrus. I do have some information here. It's interesting about the plane crash that killed Kobe Bryant and seven other people. This is in Calabasas in Southern California. And what a shock that was when that happened. And this article is in Popular Science, and it gives some background into what actually happened that resulted in the Sikorsky helicopter crashing. It crashed into the hills above Los Angeles. It says, in the minutes before the helicopter carrying Kobe Bryant and seven other passengers crashed, its pilot made a left turn. Despite initially climbing upwards, the helicopter then descended, continuing that left turn, and crashed into terrain. Among the issues at play in those moments, the National Transportation Safety Board says, was what's called spatial distortion and loss of control. Just over 1 year has passed since the incident, and yesterday the NTSB outlined their findings as to the cause of the disaster during a lengthy public presentation. Now, this article will be posted so that you can read all the details, and it even has links, for example, to the NTSB findings, if you're interested in that. Their conclusion, summarized in a statement and a short report, is that the crash stemmed from the pilot executing poor decision-making as well as experiencing spatial disorientation. Now, those of you who are pilots, you'll know exactly what this is all about. And if you're a commercial pilot, you train for this kind of thing so that it won't affect you if it should happen while you're flying. This is the kind of thing that happened to John F. Kennedy Jr. back all those years ago when he was flying his wife, and I believe it was his sister-in-law, from an airport in the New York City area, and he was flying them out to Hyannisport. And it's the same kind of thing happened. He got disoriented and didn't know whether he was going up or down. I think it was hazy that evening when he was flying, so he also had limited visibility. But he became disoriented, and he flew the plane right into the ocean, thinking that he was flying, I guess, at a level and he just flew right into the ocean and killed all three people. So they say, while multiple causes were at play, the spatial disorientation factor offers a glimpse at the ways in which a person's senses can deceive them, especially if they're flying an aircraft. Here's what to know about it and why this kind of thing happens. In the air, a pilot's senses can trick him, and that's simple because we are biological beings. I'm tripping over this stupid gender-neutral nonsense because they're putting them in everything. So they talk about a pilot's senses can trick them. So I'm going to auto-correct as I go through this because I can't stand that. And I'm going to assume for the purposes of this discussion that the pilot in question is a man, because in the case of the Kobe Bryant helicopter crash, the pilot was a man. So I'm going to undo the nonsense here in this article. So in the air, a pilot's senses can trick him, and that's simply because he is a biological being. As humans, we have evolved to judge our presence in the world and our orientation in the world by using not just one sense, but by using multiple senses, explains Jan Stepanek, a physician who studies aviation, spatial disorientation, and related issues at the Mayo Clinic, and this is the branch in Phoenix. The first of our senses is vision. We are a visually dominant species. Do your eyes tell you you're motionless? You probably are. The second sense is somatosensory, your sense of pressure and your muscle and your bone joint sense. He says that the seat of the pants feeling is what reminds you that gravity is pulling you straight down, for example. But the most important sense in this case is the neurovestibular system, which are the sensors in your inner ear that allow you to detect that you're moving. Motions like acceleration in a car or rolling from side to side. But your vestibular system has an Achilles heel. And the same doctor that I just quoted says, the problem with those sensory organs in our inner ears is that they are great at sensing change, especially rapid change, but they're very poor at sensing gradual change. And this is where they can be easily tricked. Now, the reason I'm sharing this with you is there's a God door here. You may say, what? How do you get a God door out of the Kobe Bryant crash? How does that work? Well, I'll show you. It can happen rapidly, she says. She says, if you were to sit in an office chair with your eyes closed and someone were to rotate it very smoothly at a constant rate, eventually your vestibular system would be thrown off. First, you'd feel as if your rate of rotation was slowing down, even though it's not. Then after about 20 seconds, you may feel like you're not moving. You can trick your inner ear, especially the semicircular canals, within a very brief period of time. The chair keeps moving constantly, and with your eyes shut, you think you're motionless. The same problem can happen while piloting an aircraft. Of course, if the pilot has good visual cues of the world around him, not them, any confusing sensations can be corrected. But on a moonless night or in the clouds, vision won't help you. The pilot must rely on instruments to reveal the truth. What this really means in reality is that an aircraft can be gradually banking and the pilot doesn't notice, especially when flying through fog. And that's what happened with JFK Jr. Their vestibular systems think they're level. Without a warning system, you may, with a high degree of confidence, actually have controlled flight into terrain courtesy of spatial disorientation. And it happens, and it appears that this is exactly what happened in the Kobe Bryant case. Some pilots experience a related phenomenon called the leans, L-E-A-N-S. Imagine a pilot is in a gradual, constant left turn but doesn't realize it. And the inner ear's liquid is not moving. Suddenly, the pilot notices that he has banked when he looks at the instruments and moves the aircraft back to level flight. The inner ear's sensor is then stimulated in the opposite direction and will give the pilot the perception that he is not level, but that he is actually banking to the right. The aircraft's instrument correctly tells the pilot the plane is level, but the inner ear tells him incorrectly that he has banked too much, and the pilot may physically lean to the left or turn to the left to feel normal in his body. Those mixed messages last about 20 seconds. This is fascinating in a horrifying kind of way, where, you know, who are you going to believe, your lying eyes or these instruments on the plane? So even if the instruments show that you're doing one thing, if your body is telling you you're doing something else and you go with what your bodily sensation is telling you, you may crash into the ground or to the ocean. Now, there's more detail in this article, but here's where I think there's a God door. In the God door is this is analogous to going through life, where your instruments can be thought of analogously as your conscience, which identifies for you things that are right and wrong. Do this, don't do that. It's like the nervous system in your soul, if you want to think of it that way. So the nervous system in your body is designed to warn you of injury by causing pain. That's the purpose of pain when it comes to your nerve endings. The whole point of it is to make you stop doing what you're doing that can hurt you. So you'll feel pain after the fact, but you can also feel pain before something drastic happens. If you touch a hot surface on the stove, for example, you pull your hand back suddenly because you feel the pain, and that pain is good in the sense, I mean, it's terrible to feel it, but it's good because it prevents you from burning your hand off. If you couldn't feel the pain, you might destroy your hand, etc. So in a similar kind of way, if you go through life where you're trusting, like, say, your appetites or your desires for whatever it may be, and you're ignoring your instrument panel, and in this case, that's your conscience, which is telling you, nope, don't do that. That's not good for you. Don't do that. Then you can crash and burn. And that's what happens all the time. It's part of the moral landscape in which we live right now. So yes, I would say, in the same way that the pilots have to consult their own physical, you know, spatial orientation that the article talks about, you have to do that. You have to consider things in that way, but you also have to check the instruments. And if the instruments are telling you you're flying downward or you're in a turn, you have to make those course corrections, otherwise you crash and burn. So even a story just about something as, you know, clinical as a helicopter crash can yield up some interesting angles when you consider it from that point of view, don't you think? 888-914-9149. And Cyrus is getting all these posted on the show page. It's on our Twitter feed, but if you want to just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll find everything embedded there as well. Let's go to Max now in St. Louis. Hi, Max. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi, Max.
I have a question about angels.
Okay.
I was reading religion, and it said the angels take the body of human. Does that mean if I meet a person, they could actually be an angel, or would it just be like God putting an image in my brain?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, angels, as you probably know, are pure spirits, so they don't have bodies the way we do. They don't have that. But God does permit angels to take human form so they can appear to us in what would look like a body. And the Bible says that there are times when you might meet an angel. So in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 2, it says, Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. So the idea there is that sometimes God permits the angels to interact with us, and we don't always necessarily know that they're angels. A lot of people have guardian angel stories where in some way or another their guardian angel helped them and was in the form of what looked like a human being, but it was actually an angel. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So what book Thank about you. Angels? You're welcome. What's the book you're reading about angels?
It is Our Catholic Legacy.
Very good.
I'm homeschooled.
Oh, very good. I'm happy for you. Well, one suggestion, if your mom and dad want to spring for another book for you, I would recommend a book called Angels and Devils by Joan Carol Cruz. It's a really good book, and it talks a lot about what does the Bible say about angels. It has stories from the lives of the saints about angels, and even like what St. Thomas Aquinas had to say about angels. It's really good.
Thank you. My mom just wrote it down.
Okay. Well, tell your mom thank you for letting you call the show today. I appreciate it, Max. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I was shocked when I saw this story and kind of repulsed by it. A bunker built by German troops in northern France during World War II has been restored and refitted as an underground guest house. The northern coast is strewn with fortifications left by the German army, which built up the so-called Atlantic Wall to try to fend off the Allied forces. This is on the Breton coast. Concrete bunkers are half buried along the sandy beaches in an area that once operated as a radar station. One person bought up a plot of land around one of them and spent 18 months digging it out and renovating a 400 square meter structure, turning it into a rental for up to 8 people, complete with a bar and a living room. This is a Nazi bunker, and it's outfitted with Nazi things. You know, it's got helmets, guns, signs on the wall. Apparently, it's successful because people are renting space to stay in this place. But my reaction to it is, why would you want to stay in a place where so many horrible things happen? And not to mention something that is, you know, all around you are memories of what the German soldiers did, you know, under the orders of Hitler. My reaction would be, why? Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to stay in a place like that? And so needless to say, I probably will not be booking any time at this bunker, but plenty of people are. And I don't get it. You get it, Cyrus? Would you want to stay at a place like that?
No, I'd rather stay at the Overlook Hotel.
Now, in the book, the Overlook Hotel blew up.
Yep, burned down.
Yeah, that's right. The boiler blew up.
That's right.
And the whole thing went up. Yeah, it burned down. In the movie, though, it's still there, right?
It is. That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if you ever go on those winding roads, it may still be there.
Well, apparently this is so off topic of what we usually talk about, but they have refurbished that old hotel, and you can go there and they have a big axe and you can take a picture on the steps and in front of a fireplace.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, now this makes me wonder, because the Overlook Hotel that you see in the movie, the outside of it, that's a real hotel.
Right.
But the inside that you see in the movie is not in that hotel. They built that whole set.
Yes, and so that's what they made the inside of the actual hotel.
Oh,
look like.
They gutted it and redid
it. That's what I read. I have not been there, but I have a friend that sent me a picture, and they were traveling through, and he has a picture with the axe, and he's got that devilish smile on.
Would you ride a big wheel down the empty corridors of that hotel by yourself?
Yes, I would.
Hello, Cyrus.
Come play with us forever and ever.
When I first saw it in 1979, I jumped out of my skin when those two girls showed up, when he's playing darts,
yeah,
and you see the girls for the first time. And I got to tell you, Stanley Kubrick, genius. How he filmed that in the way he did that, I don't know what exactly he did, but that to me was the single, I mean, every time these girls appeared, that was the most frightening thing about it.
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And apparently he broke Shelley Duvall. Like he made her do that scene on the steps like 85 times or something.
Oh,
and
my.
So by the end,
no wonder she was crying in hysterical.
That's exactly right. Those are, he really, I mean, that's abuse, what he did to that poor woman.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, I don't wish that on anybody. And you know what? Here's another thing. That cured me of any interest ever again seeing any kind of a horror movie. I just will not see it under any circuit. Now, that movie I've seen many times because I think it's a piece of art, but it just cured me. And never again would I go see a horror movie of any kind.
You're a stronger man than me. I love them. I don't know.
I don't get it.
It's a weird guilty pleasure.
Empty calories for me.
They are. They really are. They're brainless. Yeah, but fun.
Hello, Cyrus. I could see you on a big wheel.
I totally derailed this whole show.
You could be riding down the hallways. If you go there and get a picture of that, please send it to me. Let's go to Barbara in Berwyn, Illinois. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I listen to your program all day long as well as the rest of Relevant
thank
Radio.
You.
The reason for my call, I'll try to make this as short as possible. I'd like to get your opinion. I've prayed about this. I'm on my knees to God every day, you know, with this issue. Mm-hmm. We have a disgruntled neighbor who owns a building next door to us. He's only been here for 6 years. We've been at our home for 40-something years, and my husband and I have gone through a lot of serious medical conditions, and we've always been helpful people. We always extend our selves to our neighbors. You know, we try to, you know, be nice. And this new neighbor, this didn't start out this way, but all of a sudden he started turning because I believe it's because of our race. And he just started harassing us. My husband,
because of your race?
Yeah.
Are you an ethnic mm-hmm. minority, or are you white, or what is your...
No, we're white, you know, okay. And he's an ethnic minority person, and but we love him and his wife, and we shared, you know, food across the fence, Christmas gifts, and all of a sudden, you know, he started getting... there was a change in his personality, and I don't know what caused it. So, I mean, shortly after my mother died, he knew we were going through a lot for the last 5 years. She passed away in 2017. And he said to me, why don't you sell your house and go live at your mother's place? And you're on my property. Your plants are on my property. And your Christmas tree that you have in your yard is coming through my fence. So he started to erect a fence with some plants on it that became intrusive into our yard. So we had to try to resolve this. Mm-hmm. We tried talking to them first, and it didn't get us anywhere, so we had to call an inspector, and they had to take it down because it was just, it just became so much that it would involve taking over our whole yard eventually.
In the interest of time, Barbara, only because we have a break coming, how would you summarize the question that you want to ask me? This is an unfortunate situation you're in.
What would you do with somebody who you know hates you and makes it very well known?
And I missed the word. Somebody you know who does what?
Hates you.
Oh, hates you. Okay. Well, I immediately thought of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5. He says, I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So as a fundamental, I would say, don't return his hostility with hostility. It can be aggravating, obviously, and it can be even infuriating, but at the same time, Jesus is calling you to not give back to him what he's doing to you. Could you just simply pull back where you don't communicate? You know, I mean, I know it's awkward, but is there any compelling reason why you'd have to interact with these neighbors?
Not really. It's just that there's an issue with him putting up a large fence, and it's not according to code. Mm-hmm. And the inspector, when he was here last time, said if something like this happens, to call him. But I just feel uncomfortable doing something like that because I feel the Lord says, you know, not to do something bad to your neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's... I mean, if it's a hazard, if it's against the homeowner association rules, I mean, there could be some reasons why you would want to to interfere if it's, you know, causing a real problem. If it's not causing you a problem, in a way, maybe some upside is it will block him from view. I mean, if it's a fence that's mm-hmm. tall enough, you don't have to look at him. That might right. be a good thing. And it's at his expense, too, which is even better.
Well, the thing of it is there's a chain link fence, and I think he's going to put up another fence against that, and that's illegal. So I don't know. I mean,
it's a nuisance.
But, I mean, I pray to God every day. I know the Bible scripture says, you know, if you only love those who love you, you know, what good is it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But this is, I don't know how long we're going to live, and I don't want to walk around hurting people or my husband and I feeling that we are not being the Christian people who God wants us to be. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is hard. It really is hard because...
I can understand.
It's hurtful, too.
Sure. Yeah. And when Jesus said, love your enemies, you know, he says, do good to those who persecute you, people who are actively making your life miserable, and yet we're called to love them. So maybe the best advice I can give you, Barbara, is try to return, you know, his mean-spiritedness with calm and peace. And it may mean that you're just going to have to, I mean, if you choose to go this route, and I think it would be a noble route to take, where you just are going to live with that inconvenience and that irritation, and you offer it up. And just imagine how much purgatory time you can avoid if you offer up all these situations. And, you know, when the time comes and you go to heaven, you can thank that neighbor because he helped to purify you. And mm-hmm. in your patience, you will have become a holier woman as a result of that. I know it's easier said than done, but you sound like a very gentle, calm person. I would just keep pursuing that.
I try to. I mean, you know, we tried talking to him, and I even said something to him in Latin from the Latin Mass, you know, which says, don't let the devil, you know, get a hold of you, mm-hmm. and God bless you, you know. And mm-hmm. he kind of turned around to me, and he just looked at me, you know, and I said, we love you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. All you can do is what you can do, and it may be just time for patient offering it up to the Lord. I can imagine how difficult it is, but I think you're on to the right way of handling this, Barbara. And you know, if all else fails and it just gets worse and worse, then build a 10-foot fence of your own on your side of the chain link fence. You know, do it up to code, but build it tall enough that you never have to see him and he never sees you. And maybe that's the way to handle it. Anyway, I hope it smooths out for you, Barbara. I've got to take a break. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Here we go. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Awesome song. Let's go to Gail in Spirit, Wisconsin. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Patrick. I'm calling in regard to the sweet little wife that called your program about a problem with her husband. And I heard it last night in the middle of the night on one of the replays of your show. So I don't know if it was yesterday or whenever. But Maria finally got around after your gentle questioning to telling you that her husband was seeking power.
Right. I remember that.
And
part.
I mean, that brought me up. I turn on my light and I go, I know. I know about that because years and years ago, my husband, God rest his soul now, was in Arizona on a consultation assignment with the chemical industry. And he was a chemical engineer, and he lived out in the desert in this neat little mobile home. And one day, while he was gone to his assignment, to his job, we were in California, on our doorstep was this package wrapped in brown paper. And I opened it up because he wasn't there, and I never, you know, I never bothered either one of us to open mail addressed to the other. But this was a package of material so occult, it was nauseating.
Mm-hmm. What'd you
and
do with it?
It was how to control people. It was how to have power over people.
What did you do with it, Gail?
And, pardon?
What did you do with that parcel?
Well, I wrapped it safely, and I put it under our little family altar until he got home. And I asked him, why did this come to our house? And he said, well, I ordered it. And I said, where did you find out even how to order such a thing? And he handed me a stack of journals for chemical engineers, professional journals. And in the back of those journals are these little snippets of classified ads.
Mm-hmm.
And he found this material in a classified ad.
So how did it all end up, Gail? What, I mean, did he decide to turn away from this? What happened?
No, I said, Jack, you're going to have to choose me or this. And we were having issues. We had had issues for a long time. And our relationship had been breaking down. But I believe our family life, when he said, well, he chose to go with that material. And our family life just completely vaporized.
Yeah, I can understand. I'm so sorry to hear that that happened. But that is an example of why when people start dabbling with the occult, it's just going to cause all kinds of damage, seen and unseen. Well, Gail, I'm happy to hear that you got through that unscathed. I'm sorry to hear that that happened, though. And everyone listening, just take to heart what Gail is saying. You don't want that stuff in your life. Thank you, Gail. God bless you. Let's go to Bob in Naples, Florida. Hi, Bob.
How are you, Patrick?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. The question I had for you is, if you've read a book by a guy named Rod Dreher, Live Not by Lies, you had any opinion on it, if you've read it?
I haven't read it, no. I know who he is. I had dinner with him once long ago, but I've never read any of his books, so I don't really know. Why, is there something about it?
Well, if everything plays out the way he's written this, and a lot of it's driven by, from a political perspective, the progressive socialist sort of agenda going on, even to the liberal side. I'm listening to it as an audio book right now because...
just tell me the reason why it's...
Share the net of it.
Yeah.
I think you would find it, and your listeners would find it interesting in that the outcome for kind of where we're at in society today and where things have been sort of going on for years now, the ultimate outcome is, you know, puts us in a situation here in the United States that, again, you would just, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you'd shake your head and you'd say, this wouldn't happen in the United States.
Yeah.
But yet, he's got some very conclusive evidence that would lead, I think, all of us to believe that this is a real possibility. I'm only about halfway through it,
mm-hmm.
but I'm just, you know, it would be interesting to get some others' perspectives on this book.
I wish I could help you out on that one, Bob. As I say, I have not read it, haven't read any of his books, so I'm afraid I'll have to... not be much use to you today. But anyway, I'm glad you called. I'm glad to know you're listening to the show. I hope you stay safe on the highways. Thank you. Let's go now to Ian, who's listening in Sacramento. Hi, Ian.
Hey there. I will be quick. I have been listening to you for like 12 years, actually.
Wow,
and
thank you.
I want to let you know my wife and my kids, we all got baptized and joined the church in January this year. So
wonderful.
After going through catechism for a year.
Welcome home.
I just want to say thank you. Appreciate your show. Let's do it every day. My kid loves it. He's 2.5 now, and he likes listening to it every day and asks for it. So
he's 2.5.
We pray for you.
Yep. He's 2.5 years old. Wow. And he likes the show. He probably doesn't understand any of it, though, does he?
No, he doesn't, but he knows the name.
Well, that's good. So what was for you, what was the trigger to make you come home to the Catholic Church?
About 12 years ago, I found some podcast. I don't even remember it, but they were talking about how there's no salvation outside the church. And I was like, I need to look into that. So started looking into that, started listening to your show back when it was Immaculate Heart Radio, doing the rosary with Father Benedict Groeschel. So that was the trigger.
Wonderful. Well, that makes me very happy. Welcome home to you and your wife, and may God grant you many happy years in the Catholic Church. That's awesome. Thank you, Ian. How about Joseph now in Minneapolis? Hi, Joseph.
Patrick, thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm hoping you can please help me and my family because it's a bit of a difficult time. Okay. We lost our dear aunt. Of course, it was their mother, my cousins, and we all love her and are going to miss her very much.
Yeah.
There's some turbulence in the family, it's my understanding, because she, as a practicing Catholic, will, by the grace of God, get to have a funeral mass. However, those who are not practicing the Catholic faith at this point would have other preferences, and I'm hoping you could please explain, and maybe I'll even play this as a recording for some of them who might be willing to listen, as to why it's important that we as Catholics have a funeral mass for our deceased, and why the church teaches it to be so important.
Okay, that's a great question, and let me begin by offering you my sincere condolences, you and your whole family. I'm very sorry to hear that your aunt passed away, and I ask God to comfort you and console you. So the reason that the church desires that there be a mass of Christian burial, as it's called, is because it is the fitting and proper way to show the final respects to the person who has died. And keep in mind that once somebody has died, nothing that happens in this life after that person's death affects the person's eternal destiny. So if your aunt is on her way to heaven, please God, or maybe there's time in purgatory, or in the case of those who go to hell, whether there's a funeral mass or no funeral mass doesn't affect that in any way whatsoever, because as it says in Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. So the funeral mass is for us. The funeral mass is not only a reminder of our own mortality and that someday you will be in that coffin and you will be being buried and people will be hopefully praying for you. So it's for us, but it's also as a way to demonstrate the respect that we have in the church for a temple of the Holy Spirit. So this aunt of yours, I'm presuming, of course, that she was Catholic, and so by virtue of her baptism and receiving the sacraments, she, bodily speaking, was a temple of the Holy Spirit. And so that deserves respect, and that's what the Mass of Christian Burial does. Now, the one thing that the Mass of Christian Burial does for the person who's departed, which is very important, it doesn't change that person's destiny one way or the other. But if the person, if your aunt, for example, is in purgatory, then the benefits for her are that that would help to shorten her time in purgatory, because it's a Mass that's offered on her behalf or for the repose of her soul. The same is true for the rosary that you pray. Typically, it would be prayed maybe the night before at the funeral home. So the rosary intention helps the person if he or she is in purgatory. If she's in heaven already, then it's unnecessary. She doesn't need that help, but it's applied by God to somebody else in purgatory. But if she's in purgatory, then there is a special benefit to her. That's why you should continue to pray for her, continue to have masses offered for the repose of her soul. Those are all very good things to do. And that's the other part, the third part, I guess, of how I would answer your question. Does that help? Does that clarify it a bit better?
Well, it does. What would be a good response then, because there will be those who want what they will call a celebration of life, and how
you can do that too. Yeah. So what I would say in that case is, hey, let's have a celebration of her life. Let's do that too. But let's do that after the funeral mass. So when we go into the church hall to have our bereavement luncheon, we'll get up to the microphone and everybody will share wonderful memories of her, and we can laugh and cry and celebrate and remember. So they're not mutually exclusive. And so I would say, let's respect her and let's respect her wishes. She was a Catholic and this is what she wanted. And let's honor that. And it doesn't mean you can't have that celebration of life. You just do it afterward. That'd be my suggestion. Well, thank you, Joseph. And again, my sincere condolences. Let's go to Tom now in Front Royal. Hi, Tom. I don't have a lot of time, but welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'll make it quick then. In Mass, it just struck me that they say, I'm a former Protestant, by the way, mm-hmm. when they say, I am not worthy that you should enter in my roof, but just say the word and my soul shall be healed, right. when Scripture doesn't say that. It just bothers me that they've changed the words, but you probably have a really good explanation.
Oh, I hope so. Well, as you probably know, in Matthew 8, verse 8, that's where the centurion says to Jesus, Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word and my servant will be healed. And so right. the church is basically invoking this passage, even though it was, you know, the circumstances were different. But it's a beautiful way of showing the faith that the centurion, who wasn't even a Jew, showed to Jesus. So the word soul is used instead of servant because Jesus is coming into our bodies physically by his real presence in the Eucharist. Boy, I wish I had more time. This is an important question. Well, there's a little bit. I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you, Tom. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.